Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield
on 702
for the curious
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
No time for fluffy pleasantries and broad sweeping openings. The Money Show brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. Lots to come on tonight's show. The 1 hour version. We'll wrap it up with the brutal biz quiz. But first, the breaking story this evening, and that is that the report created by PwC over the last 14, 15 months, the investigation into Steinhoff has been handed to the company. The company has published the highlights package, if you like, 14 pages on its website. Analysis this evening with Rob Rose, the author of Stein Heist, the editor at Financial Mail. Just glancing through, and I've only had a moment to glance through this report from PwC, Rob Rose, it seems to confirm what you wrote in your book, what, 8-9 months ago?
Yeah, Bruce, thankfully it seems to confirm much of it, but it was very short on detail. I think investors expected a much longer version of this. I mean, it was basically 10 pages, and I do know some people close to Steinhoff have been scrutinizing an executive summary that runs to more like 65 pages. So I think that they've sanitized this quite heavily to avoid naming people, to avoid any legal liability, and I suppose to also avoid tipping off people as to who to pursue when Steinhoff would like to pursue them itself for money taken.
Yeah, I mean, the obviously the report doesn't disappear. The report stands, and the report will be used to do those investigations. This, however, does give us the highlights package, if you like, of what happened. I mean, the investigation found a pattern of communication. It shows senior management executives instructing a small number of other Steinhoff executives to execute on instructions. It suggests that this was very contained in a trusted clique inside the group to carry out what turned out to be a massive fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it did talk about how, interestingly, it didn't name these executives. It talked about the small group of executives, but, you know, it's very clear it would seem at this stage that Marcus Yoster is central to this. But it did talk of how there were certain people close to him who facilitated this, and it did provide certain stuff, that confirmation of certain facts, like, for example, documents were forged, legal documents forged to substantiate transactions. And the other thing, Bruce, that I think is really important about it that we didn't know, it puts a number to the value of fictitious and irregular transactions. And that number was 6.5 billion euros.
Sorry. 6.5 billion euros worth of transactions went undetected for how long?
Between 2009 and 2017. So that's quite a long period of time. These were, you know, the fictitious and irregular transactions through all these companies overseas that weren't quite independent, like Steinhoff claimed they were.
I mean, these were transactions dressed up to look like third-party transactions, and in fact, they were related-party transactions, and that's always been at the core of what people suspected had happened within Steinhoff. I mean, it certainly does give, it'll make some nice light weekend reading. It's nice and easy to read. Is there anything in here that surprises or shocks you that you've been able to see in the last half hour since it appeared?
Well, I do think that number is pretty important, the 6.5 billion euros. I mean, essentially, these were deals, like you said, in which Steinhoff was selling, for example, its trademarks and brands to these companies in Switzerland that were notionally independent but actually weren't. And essentially, it had the effect of boosting Steinhoff's profit to make it look like it was doing better than it was, and essentially deceiving investors and deceiving thousands of pension funds in South Africa. So it's a wide-sweeping fraud that has deceived a lot of people in this country. So that I think was important. I mean, I think the fact that it provided a methodology with how it did it, and it was very complicated, and it's worth a read. It's quite short. But otherwise, I mean, I do think we knew the basics of it, but this adds flesh to those bones.
My thanks to Rob Rose, coming through at very, very short notice for us this evening, the author of Stein Heist, the editor at the Financial Mail. No big shocks in there. That's 6.5 billion euros of related party transactions, basically dressing up transactions to look like they're being done with independent third parties, but you're doing them with yourself or with your buddies, and you're basically enriching yourself at the expense of shareholders. And you are one of those shareholders. There is no doubt in my mind that the vast majority of South Africans with any kind of pension fund would have had some shares in Steinhoff. It matters, and it matters to you.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield.
Live.
Online.
Smartphones.
DSTV.
And 92.7. And
from that breaking story, of a story we kind of knew already, but it's good to see the confirmations coming through, onto one of a different kind. The chief executive of Anglo-American Platinum, Chris Griffith, on the line to us this evening. Handing over land, Chris Griffith, in Rustenburg, 270 hectares of land on top of another 242. I mean, you've handed over several hundred hectares of land in recent years over to municipalities as part of a land reform process. Explain what you're doing.
Hi, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. So, Bruce, you know, I think what we've wanted to do for a number of years is be part of a more constructive narrative on land reform. So we're all aware of the discussions around expropriation of land without compensation, and the fact that they're wanting to change the constitution or not. And we've for a number of years looked at land and said, is there land that we have that we're not using and that we can more constructively use to be part of a different narrative on land reform? So a number of years ago, we donated a large piece of land, more than 200 hectares, to government. And as part of that partnership with government, the local municipality, and also the Department of Human Settlements, we agreed that we'd all do some things to create another 4,000 houses. So in the particular area, we then put in bulk services to 140 million rand to enable the top structure. So government can now come and build 4,000 additional houses. So that was the one thing we handed over today, was the bulk infrastructure. We also handed across four parcels of land, as you said, of 270 hectares to government that will enable them to facilitate various housing projects in the Rustenburg region, in the municipality. So it's exactly what the president has been calling for, yeah. Saying that we're wanting to create land where we can bring people closer to economic activity.
I mean, and let's face it, I mean, the what you need above ground is a fixed amount of land that you can secure to put your infrastructure on. You're really interested in what's happening underground. I mean, the land above your mines is essentially land which you can release.
Yeah, I mean, there's some land that we have to keep for our infrastructure, as you would imagine, but there certainly is land, and not only our company, but we believe many more mining companies and more private companies, for that matter, must have land that they could positively contribute towards government. So I think this is a much more positive discussion and a much more positive contribution that we're seeking to develop in the country. And hopefully by our actions, hopefully some of the other companies will come up with that. But as you point out, we don't need all the land that we have. And there's, in this particular case, were four very sizable portions of land that we've been able to hand over to government.
Chris Griffith, thanks for chatting. The chief executive of Anglo-American Platinum. Corporates doing their bit to help government to facilitate transformation of land ownership. It's a good story. Thank you very much for that, Chris Griffith. On to another tale this evening of a different kind, and that is the whole story about the jobs, the layoffs at Standard Bank. 1,200 jobs announced yesterday that would probably go in a big transformation of the Standard Bank business. The most interesting part of it, other than if you're affected, of course, one of the 1,200, is that there are going to be 91 branch closures, effectively one out of every six Standard Bank branches being closed. Now, most of you will have no idea what it's like spending your lunch hour on a Saturday morning at a bank queue, because there's very little reason for you to do so. You don't have to do it anymore. There would have been a number of revolutions in banking that have made it really convenient over the last 30 years. The advent of the credit card, the ATM, was a revolution. It took people out of the queues and put them outside, and people could get money 24 hours a day. It did change the world. Since then, internet banking has changed everything. And it's the primary reason that Standard Bank is closing these 91 branches and cutting staff by 1,200. It simply doesn't need the branches or the people. And you don't go there anymore to talk to people anymore. You use applications, use call centers. That's the way we have changed. Those are the two starting realities. But this is the beginning, and I don't think have even begun to see the effects of the fourth industrial revolution yet. This is all transformation that still relies on basic computing. The real revolution is yet to come. Cliff DeWitt is co-founder at Dexterity Digital. And my memory banks are rusty, Cliff, but if I recall, at some point in the distant past, you were involved in building South Africa's first banking website, weren't you?
Hey, good evening, Bruce. Yeah, your memory is not rusty. It's spot on as usual. Yeah, I was part of the team that started the very first internet banking in South Africa at Nedbank. And it was an incredibly interesting journey. I think in, just to put some numbers on the table quickly, I think we started sort of as an experiment. And in 4 months, we were by size the biggest branch in the bank.
But adoption of internet banking was quite slow. I mean, that was impressive, that early take-up. But then internet banking seemed to plateau and didn't really have that much traction. There was quite a lot of a big trust issue with people and the internet and money, and then the scams happened and people got very nervous of the internet for a while.
Yeah, it was. And I think that's natural with any sort of new technology. There's always the early adopters, and then sort of before it becomes really mainstream, I think these technologies have to prove themselves. And there's always, as you say, one or two teething issues. But I think the reality is that technology moves, and it sometimes moves very quickly. And when it does, it has very, very large effects on traditional ways that people are serviced or industries. And I think the example of what we're seeing today is a really good example of that, of how as the technology becomes mainstream, it really revolutionizes different parts of business. And as I said, it has real effects. So I think we're living in that reality. You said the fourth industrial revolution effects are really only starting to take place, and I fully agree with you. I think we are going to start. This is just signs of times to come.
Yeah, because I mean, we haven't done that much in terms of AI and fourth industrial revolution in banking yet. We've gone from the internet to mobile. Mobile has gone from old style SMS type technologies to people using apps, and suddenly apps have created the desktop experience on a phone, and now people feel a lot more secure about that transaction mechanism. But the digital revolution is coming now. We're still using almost third industrial revolution technologies, and it's beginning to have an impact. I'm a little bit scared of what's coming if banks are closing one out of six branches in order to accommodate people's changing habits.
Yeah, look, and I think the reality is that nobody really knows what the impacts of this is going to be. The way I like to contextualize it is that I think we're inventing a new tool. And you can kind of look back in history. I like to do that, kind of see if there's anything we can reference. The reality is when these technologies happen, things change. I mean, when a car was invented, there were, blacksmiths went out of business. When digital cameras came around, film was dead. And there's many examples of this. I think what we're going to start seeing, like you say, with the fourth industrial revolution is what these intelligence machines now do. And I suppose that's the scary part, because they're becoming, in some ways, more human. And so they're challenging many of the mundane tasks that humans would perform. I firmly believe it is going to have a fundamental effect on the way we see the workforce today. I guess the optimistic view is that it'll allow humans to do more intelligent work and more sort of fulfilling work. But will we need to reskill some of our people to not do those mundane tasks? I absolutely believe so. And I think it begs the whole question on the education system and what are we doing to embrace sort of the digital economy and, I guess, the knowledge economy, which is inevitably where the world is going.
And we've been talking about this for such a long time. And suddenly, just this week, as a result of this big move by Standard Bank, it suddenly just feels very real and very here and very present.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's how these things all happen, right? They creep up on us, and then all of a sudden they become a reality. And as you said, I think it's the start of a lot more of this to come.
Cliff Savitt, thank you. The co-founder of Dexterity Digital. It happens very, very slowly. Slowly, slowly. And then suddenly it's all different. And it feels like this was one of those weeks where that happened.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
David Peacock is with Sunland Private Wealth. He's today's market commentator. There was just this mad frenzy of activity at 5:22 this afternoon before the market closed, and an extraordinary volume of shares being traded. What happened?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. Yeah, basically in the closing auction and then subsequent close, the volume traded before the close was 17 odd billion, and at the close the volume was 43 billion.
That's huge.
So if only we could have that a lot more frequently. So very simply, we had quite a few changes to the FTSE, the various FTSE indices. So, for example, Anglo Platts went into the SWIX. So that share was sort of up 7%. So that obviously made Chris Griffith very happy this evening. Anglo Gold also went into the SWIX as well, so that was up sort of 4%. Impala replaced Glencore in the Resi index.
But what you're talking about here is where as companies change shape and size and as valuations change, they move their places within indices. And the simplest way of describing it is if you are the 40th biggest company on the JSE in terms of value and you're worth 100 billion rand, that's a bit big, 20 billion rand, yeah. And suddenly company number 41, which was 19 billion, is now worth 21, they replace you. At some point. So, and this happens every so often.
That's exactly right, Bruce. And basically that value is determined by market capitalization, which is effectively the share price multiplied by the number of shares in issue at the particular time. So that's the reason why we had that sort of move. So it is an unusual move. It wasn't because we suddenly were the flavor of the month in terms of foreign investors. So I would say that, you know, you'll see that the volumes will sort of decrease on Monday again. In terms of the move in the market, we didn't see substantial moves. So, for example, the index wasn't up sort of 3% or 4%. It was up sort of 0.8 or somewhere around there. So that's the reason why we had such a big volume on the JSE today.
Thank you for that. And what's going to happen to Steinhoff on Monday? They very strategically released the redacted report, the shortened version of the PwC report, the easy-to-read version without names and details. Rob Rowe's not impressed with that. But they did that at 5:30 on a Friday afternoon, which should give the market the weekend to figure out what to do next. But Steinhoff, under 2 rand a share, used to be the sixth biggest company on the JSE.
Yeah.
Does this provide clarity or does it finally break it?
Yeah, Bruce, it's an interesting one because the share closed about 5-odd% low this afternoon around, I think it was 185, 187, somewhere there. So you get the impression that you know, pretty much that is in the market at the moment. And to an extent, I don't know to what end the comments that are coming out here are really unknowns. So from that perspective, I think a number of those issues have been covered already. And I don't think that you'll see the share coming under significant pressure until such time as you see the sort of the next step in terms of the process as to, you know, getting back some of these bonuses that were paid, etc. Like how exactly will that pay? How will that play out? And in terms of, for example, the sort of 6.5 billion euros between the period of 2009 and 2017, what is the impact that is going to have on the financials? So I think we've got a bit of time in terms of when you're really going to see what actually happens here. But I think in general, it's probably not looking like you're going to see significant improvement in the share in the shorter term.
Yeah, no, certainly not. I mean, one that we'd like to see some improvement in is Aspen Pharmacare. Basically, is where it was last Friday after that huge drop-off in the value of Aspen Pharmacare. 50% at one point last Friday, closed 30% down. Yeah. Tried valiantly to recover this week, but is back in the doldrums.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the 50% move was pretty much on the back of probably equities linked to loans that various people had. There was probably a lot of derivative action that happened there as well. There's a lot of algorithms that are playing in our market at the moment where, you know, the algorithm doesn't stand back and say, okay, well, it'll be better this afternoon. It'll only be down 30%. The algorithm basically says, if this happens, then that must happen. So you get these massive moves of sort of 50% and then it's settled 30%. And what you've seen in the last couple of days is the market just re-rating in terms of, well, from a valuation point of view, from a debt perspective in terms of this company, this is the sort of look going forward. So I would say that what you're seeing in the price now is more reflective of the market's actual valuation of Aspen and the fact that, you know, going forward from here, they also are going to have a bit of a tough time in this market going forward.
Yeah, I suspect they will. A couple of companies, though, doing well. Let's focus on some happiness, shall we? Let's focus on four that I've chosen randomly. Libstar, MultiChoice, MMI, yep, and Quilter, double-digit gainers in a week of despair.
Yeah, so MultiChoice is another anomaly because MultiChoice went into the index today as well. So, for example, MultiChoice was up, I think it was up sort of 4% or something, or almost 5%. So, again, that's on the basis of first of all, going into the index. The second thing from a multi-choice perspective is that from a valuation point of view, now that I would think a fair amount of the sort of overhang in terms of shareholders that didn't want the multi-choice share are out of the way now. Now I think the market is starting to realize value in terms of what is the Africa business looking like? Will they close down non-profit making businesses? You know, what will be the impact there? And that sort of takes you to the point where, from a valuation point of view, for example, multi-choice could be somewhere between sort of 130 to 160 rand. So you've actually had sort of quite a nice pickup in terms of the price there.
Yeah, and the market about 56,000. I know it's just a number, but one of the key drivers there, of course, the banking sector. It seems heartless, but investors are looking to future profitability of the banking sector. And with the likes of Standard Bank cutting 91 branches, that's a lot of cost taken out of the system. And the market almost seems to anticipate that the rest of the banking sector will follow suit. It's almost inevitable.
Yeah, Bruce, it's an interesting one because at one stage the banking view was that the more branches you had, the better coverage you had, therefore the more market share you had. And ultimately going forward, I agree with the sort of comments in terms of electronic banking, you know, will become far more significant. And yet it's quite interesting, a bank like, for example, Capitec, still has a decent branch perspective or exposure, and they have, if you go and look at the sort of numbers in terms of people going into the branches and through their doors, is actually very significant relative to the number of clients that they have. So I think just what you're seeing in, for example, something like a Standard Bank is that, you know, ultimately I think this has been a historic situation. Now they've taken the crunch in terms of let's reduce this, because clearly it'll have cost benefits. But I remember, you know, one sort of Friday being in one of the shopping centers where, for example, FNB offers a significant electronic facility and option, and the machines outside the bank were empty, but the queue inside the bank was quite long.
Yeah, we're still very much a cash society, and the banks have done their damnedest to get us out of the branches and get the queues forming outside. But still, sometimes, just a human touch. It's nice. Let's keep a branch, just one, and we can then remember what it was like. David Peacock from Sanlam Private Wealth.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
So on your next Money Show, I've got the co-founder of Gradich Mahura Investments, Craig Gradich, in studio for Make Money Monday Special Edition. He's most famous for the adverts that he puts of himself and his colleagues in the onboard magazines on aeroplanes. Very famous as a result. He's also pretty good with money. Let's find out how a financial advisor treats his own money and what scares him about it. Ian Mann will review the business book of the week, and the chief executives of Advertech and Sun International brave the Money Show hot seat.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield.
Live.
Online.
Smartphones.
DSTV.
And 92.7.
And 106 FM.
Time for the best bits of The Money Show. If you missed our interview this evening with Rob Rose, the editor at the FM and the author of Stein Heist, we have published that particular interview. If you want to catch up on what's happened to Steinhoff, the report being published in a redacted version at 5:30 this afternoon. Top analysis on that, live and ready on our Twitter feeds across the radio stations, and mine too, if you want to go there instead. Standard Bank cutting 1,200 jobs, closing 91 branches. It's part of its efforts to digitize its retail and business bank. It's been the topic of lots of conversation over the last 24 hours. It is a big move by the bank, and it's not going to be the last by a bank in South Africa. I suspect very much that this is the first and the opening salvo of what is going to be a massive rationalization across the banking sector. How can I say this? Well, it's happened across the United States, and it's happened across the United Kingdom quite aggressively over the last couple of years, and the rate of closures has stepped up and people have lost their jobs. I asked the chief executive of personal and business banking in South Africa at Standard Bank, Funeka Modjane, whether or not the introduction of new banks, the new upstarts, the rabble rousers, had anything to do with Standard Bank's decision.
It is going to be an exciting environment for our customers in the market, but I want to say this very clearly. This decision has nothing to do with any competitor. This decision is a response to the way in which customers are choosing to transact. Customers are no longer coming to branches frequently.
You see how Standard Bank did that? They said, no, it's not us. It's you. It's our customer's fault, not us. No, don't shout at us. Anyway, it is factual that all of us do bank differently as a result of the marvels of technology. But that does have consequences. Our Money Show Big Break, a brand new feature. It really is marvelous. And you can, if you want a big break, you can enter it via our website. Go to the Money Show page. There's a form there. We've decided to formalize it a little bit just so that you focus your messaging so that we can see exactly what it is that you want or you need. And also there's a form there if you can help in the Money Show Big Break. This week, Bonga Jwambi. He's a creative artist. He was recognized as an emerging designer by the Design in Indaba in 2015, exhibited at the V&A Waterfront in Cape Town, at Deso Ed Decorex as well. And late last year, he received an invite from the Milan Design Market in Italy. It's one of the largest events in the world. It happens during the Milan Design Week, and it's happening in less than a month. And he needs support. He needs shipping. He needs travel, accommodation. He's tried his best via traditional means, and he simply can't get a break. This was his appeal, possibly to you, if you can give a break, to help him out.
In fact, when it comes to how much I make a year, I don't qualify. There are certain rates, which is, for me, it was my first time to apply for any funding from the department. So for me to find out that there are certain rates, which is that I don't qualify, for example, how much you make annually and stuff, income you make annually. For me, as an individual, as a creative, I haven't been in the industry as much as I can. There are certain things like having export license or export certificate and stuff, which I didn't know because I didn't plan to go to Milan yet. But according to Padiz, I didn't want to miss it. But if
when is the trip, Bonga? When is the Milan Fashion Design Week?
The Milan starts from the 9th
of
next month.
Oh my goodness me! There's no time.
There's no time. But for me, I started applying from the department early last year.
He's not getting the break. He'd like you to give him a break if you can. On our website, the form's there. Fill it in. You know you want to. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, suffering another blow with the UK Parliament rejecting her Brexit plan. And it looks like they've now readying to delay Brexit indefinitely. We spoke to Lionel October, the DG in the Department of Trade and Industry, about what the British policy mess means for one of our biggest trading partners.
The good thing is at least there's a bit more clarity now because, as you know, the UK is our second biggest partner in the European Union, and we have about 80 billion rands a year of trade, you know, and it's a very big export market for our autos and for our agricultural products and our wines and so on. So, as you know, our biggest worry was that they would have a hard Brexit, they would leave without a deal. And therefore, what we have been negotiating, and we're 99% there, is to just have a sort of a rollover agreement that in the event of them leaving, we have an insurance policy that there will be no interruption with trade, because we've got 98% of our tariffs is duty-free. So we need to preserve that duty-free status. So we've mainly been working on having an insurance policy in case of a hard Brexit. But the good development now is it looks like that is more and more unlikely. At least within the madness, there is a pragmatic majority emerging for not leaving without a deal.
Lionel October at the DTI. If you missed the discussion on EOH, and lots of you are interested about EOH, it's on our Wednesday podcast. Stephen Fancola was our shapeshifter, and he paints a very clear picture of the mess that he's inherited and how he is looking to get clarity and rebuild EOH, which has got 274 businesses. It's very solid, but people don't really know what it does and don't really know where it fits. So he's looking to create 8 or 9 divisions, big divisions, clear divisions within like an investment holding company structure. It's a good interview. It's a good discussion. Have a listen on our website. Our How It Works feature this week, Martin van Doesburg, founder of Agava, which is South African for tequila, described how he distills the spirit in South Africa. He's an academic with a wonderful hobby.
We've been brewing beer for many years, and we produce our own gin and vodkas and rums and distilled other distilled products. But the agave or spirit is a totally unique product because the sugars in the piña are not easy to ferment. So the process is, to answer your question, the process is that the agave plant, the piña, then gets cooked, either roasted. What we do it in a traditional way, so we do it in a clay oven. So we roast it for 2 days, And what happens then is that the complex starches and carbohydrates convert into a fermentable sugar. We then take that cooked or roasted or baked piña and we crush it and we juice it. So it goes through a milling process and we create juice. That then is your fermentable product. So whereas with a gin or a vodka, where they might be using whatever it is, rice, certain vodkas are made with potatoes, certain vodkas are made with basic sugars, they've already got a simple sugar. So we've got to go through that process first to break down that complex carbohydrate into a simple sugar. That's then fermented, and after that, we go through the distilling process. The process.
How much juice do you get out of an 80-kilogram piña?
I thought you were going to ask that, and this is the other scary or uneconomical, if you like, aspect of this particular plant. We get 5%. So from a from a hundred kilo, well, not juice to finished product. It's easier for people to understand. So from 100 kilo piña, we will get 5 liters of tequila.
He wants a margarita. I want to emulate his voice as well. He sounds like he likes a margarita. Yes, he does.
Yes, what a prof with a lovely job making South African version of tequila. Martin van Duspera, academic, with his wonderful sort of heritage of brewing and distilling in his family over centuries, and going to Graaff-Reinet and growing these, I want to call them aloes, but they're called something else, and then getting these piñas, which take about 10 or 12 years to develop. And then all you get is 5 liters of tequila out of one of these things. That's hard work. That's also why it's so expensive. Great best bits this week. In a moment, we're going to be playing our Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night. I would like to know from you, please, this evening on The Money Show, how can this be so easy? But maybe you'll find it hard. With which bank is the word Africanacity associated? 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Africanacity, which bank's line is that?
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
The Money Show.
The Brutal Biz Quiz.
No, get it right. It's Brutal Biz Quiz. You've got to get the rrr. Otherwise, it doesn't count. It doesn't sound so scary. Tabor, which bank is associated with the word Africanacity?
It's APSA, Bruce.
It is APSA, Tabor. The group, of course, released results this week, and it's moving to its post-Barclays world. Lots of corporate questions this week. Oh, come on. Who wrote this? Which company has its headquarters at One Mutual Place in Sandton?
Old Mutual.
What was the name of the townhouse complex that was situated at One Mutual Place before Mutual Place was built?
Townhouse complex.
It was like this mock Tudor townhouse complex. You remember it now. It was white with these beams and stuff, and it had fabulous tall trees in the gardens, and they cut all the trees down. What was it called? I'm showing off now because I had a friend who lived there. It's called Shadrian Place. It is the most obscure question. I just had to make the biz quiz a bit harder, but I'm not going to gong you out. I'm not going to gong you out. Which bank yesterday announced it will close 91 branches?
Standard Bank.
I spoke, of course, to Funeka at Standard Bank, and she says it's all because of their customers, and that's why they're doing it. Which construction company was an amalgamation of at least 5 different companies which listed on the JSE in 1974? So there were 5 construction companies that came together, and they gave and they called it what?
Murray and Roberts, Group 5.
Because Murray and Roberts, you see, that's 2. Murray and Roberts. And then there was Group 5. I didn't actually know that that was the origin. That's a good question, Cecilia. Good question. I didn't know it was 5 different. Like APSA was Amalgamated Banks of South Africa, Group 5 was a group of 5 companies that amalgamated. And this week, sadly, Group 5 had its door slammed in its face, and it's gone. What type of distilled beverage is made from the blue agave plant?
It's tequila.
You're going to have one on us, Tabor, this evening, or on yourself, really. Tabor is the Wizard of the Biz Quiz. He took it. I mean, look, the question I asked him about Shadrian Place was cruel and unkind, but it was funny, and I had to amuse myself. Tabor, well done. Brutal Biz Quiz winner on this Friday night. Well, that's it from The Money Show for this Friday night. Thank you so much for listening. Back again on Monday. Have a good, safe, healthy, and wonderful weekend. Good night.